tonight's speaker as I was coming into registration. And maybe I shouldn't share this. No, I better not share this because it's okay, this is kind of X-rated. It's kind of X-rated. Okay, all right, I'm going to share it. And may God have mercy on me. Now, if this speaker jumps on me or someone out there from Chicago, then I'm going to blame you guys. I'm standing in line of registration, and there's a problem. I mean, they can't find some names or something. I don't know. So I asked Brian, I say, where's the speaker? He says, she's right up there at the registration desk. So a guy comes up and says, what's going on? And she says, there's a problem. I guess they weren't pre-registered early enough or whatever. And he said, well, you know, I got mine. And she said, you're sleeping with the speaker. But now, Richard is her husband. So, and it's okay. And I thought it was so cute. You know, I really thought it was cute. But anyway, this young lady seems to be quite nice. And I told you, if she comes over here and attacks me, I want some help. But she seems quite nice. And she's from Chicago, Illinois. And we kind of have a little common bond because I grew up in Detroit. And snow and ice and wind and cold weather is in those areas. So thank God for Athens, Georgia. I never knew it existed. So without any more from me, I give you Kelly.
Hello, everybody. My name is Kelly Landry, and I'm an alcoholic. And I believe I have to have three things active in my life today to feel comfortable in my own skin. And the first one of those is a sobriety date. My sobriety date is January 6th of 1996. And the second one is a home group. My home group is the Chicago Foxhall Group. We meet on Wednesday nights in Chicago, Illinois, on Hermitage and Armitage. If you're ever in town, we're an open speaker meeting. Please, please, please come and see us. We'd love to have you. The third thing is a sponsor. My sponsor's name is Polly P. I'm actively sponsored today, which is, I haven't always been actively sponsored. She knows where I am tonight, which is a big deal. As a matter of fact, she recommended me to speak here this evening. This is my first time. Thank you. My sponsor, Polly, and her son, James, recommended me to do this. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing like being recommended for something that is. This is a real huge honor and a privilege. I'm not sure if I've ever felt this proud. I feel it's remarkable. And I'd like to thank Dan and the committee for asking me. I know I was last minute, but this has really, really been a big deal for me. Huge. And I'd like to thank Carrie and Rick. They picked Dawn and I up for the airport today. And they were wonderful and great, and they've been amazing hosts, and I feel very grateful for that. And I'd like to thank God because I'm very afraid to fly. And when I got to the airport, I flew with Dawn C., and she's going to be the Al-Anon speaker tomorrow. And I'll tell you what, I was like, what flight? The whole time we talked, and it was amazing. And the whole flight was booked, and she told me to tell this story, so I will. We weren't sitting in the same row, and the whole flight was booked, and there was one empty seat, and it was in her row. So I was able to sit with Dawn, and it's just, you know, it's amazing how God works in my life today. So with saying all that, I'll start telling you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My sponsor told me to be honest. So I'm going to try my best to do that. It's not always so easy for me. I'm 25 years old. I got sober at 18. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. When I was 2, my parents, who were married at the time, moved to Fort Lauderdale. I spent 15 years there. My parents got divorced right away as soon as they moved down there. I think I was 3 when my parents divorced, and it was just me and my mom. And we lived in a trailer park that was 3 blocks long and 3 blocks wide. It was, for lack of a better way to say it, white trash. There was a lot of Confederate flags, a lot of pickup trucks, a lot of people barefoot. It was like, if you think about white trash... people that can relate to that here? I'm sorry. But I'm one of you guys. So it was... I'm sorry. It was surrounded by the projects. It was not in a very good neighborhood. I told you it was my first time. Note to self, keep that out when in Georgia. Okay, so it was surrounded by the projects. And the trailer park was. And I went to school, that's where I went to school, is right outside of the projects. Right outside of the trailer park, there was a school, and I was thinking, this is very important to my story. Now that I'm sober and I'm able to look back over my life, what was going on for me in the trailer park was, it was me and my mom. She was very addicted to drugs and alcohol. It was just me and her. I was an only child. She was not able to work, not able to hold down a job. She was very... there was a lot of dealing of drugs going on, a lot of sexual activity, and so like any child, I think, in that situation, I didn't want to be in the house. And what was going on outside of the trailer was I was the leader of the pack in the trailer park. The treehouse was in my yard. I was the boss. I'm very bossy, and not a lot has changed. And I was already at like 4, 5, 6, 7 years old controlling my environment. I was already calling the shots. And, you know, that was what was going on the outside. And then what was going on in school is I was the only white person in all of my grades up till 4th grade. Everybody else was African American. And I thought because of that, that's why I'd felt like I couldn't fit in. That's what I thought. I thought if you were the only white kid in an all-black school, you would feel like you didn't belong too. So what I did differently than I think maybe a non-alcoholic would have is by the time I was in 4th grade, I had convinced anybody who would listen to me that I was a quarter black. And that's insane when you're telling that to people at 7. And so that was my story, and I was willing to stick to that. I'm sure that I believed that a little bit. In 5th grade, I changed schools. I went to a school that for people that were accelerated in math, and it was a magnet school called Nova, and everybody there was Jewish. So by the time I was in 8th grade, I was a quarter black and half Jewish. I was totally confused about who I was. I was, like, just confused. And... 8th grade, I think, 12 years old, it was right about the time, 11, 12, it's like all kind of unclear, is when I started stealing roaches out of my mom's ashtray. Do you guys know what roaches are? I knew it. So I started stealing them out of the ashtray, and what I would do is I would steal them all week. And on the weekend, I would unroll them, and then I'd roll up a joint. And I'm aware this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but I got sober at 18, and drugs are a part of my story. And I'll keep them real short, real short. Sorry if there's, you know, old-timers in the room, and I offend you. Sorry. My first drink was actually a joint. And I smoked it, and what happened to me was absolutely amazing. I was okay that I was white. It was okay. after I smoked that joint. It was okay that I had never been baptized a Christian and we didn't practice religion. That was okay too. It was okay what I was seeing my mom do to herself sexually inside of that trailer and hearing and watching. That was okay. It was okay what was being done to me. Nothing really mattered. I didn't feel alone anymore. What I felt like was that this is the solution for me. And it's really important that I know that today, because I think there's some people maybe that drugs and alcohol were problematic for them. They were not problematic for me. They were my solution. It was hard for me to live without drugs and alcohol. That was unbearable. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I cannot remember ever not being restless, irritable, and discontent. We're talking 4 or 5, I felt like that. When I started doing drugs and alcohol, I felt fine. I felt normal. I felt like I can function in society. I could go out for cheerleading. I could play soccer. I could do things that I wanted to do that I knew I could do and feel like I was equal to the people I was doing them with. And so that's what started. I started with pot. Right after that, I started drinking. What happened to me when I drank is I developed the phenomenon of craving. I could not have one beer. I could not do it. I wanted to. Sometimes I didn't feel like going out and getting smashed, but I could not. I am an alcoholic, and I developed the phenomenon of craving when I put alcohol into my system. And so that's what happened. And then basically, so that was like 12. I got sober at 18. I'll tell you some facts about those 6 years. When I was 12, I left home. My mom could not support us anymore. She actually ended up doing crack, so, which is horrible, you know. And so my mom was gone. I was on my own. I lived in a efficiency from 12 to 17 and a half. It was about 8 by 10. It had a college-sized refrigerator, a single mattress on the floor with no sheets. It had mildewed carpeting. It had a bathroom with a stand-up shower. The floor was so rotten. In Florida, the houses are up on bricks because there's a lot of flooding, and the floor was rotten out. So you literally had to, like, balance yourself to go to the bathroom. And I didn't go to school. I dropped out. I followed the Grateful Dead around. I hate that part. But I did do that. And I was dirty and smelly. And when I was 14, I had my first felony. I had 5 by the time I was 18. I spent a year in the juvenile penitentiary from 16 to 17 for just stupid stuff. I was not a smart, clever drug addict. I was just out of it. And life was, for those 6 years that I spent in Florida using, I had absolutely no guidance. By the time I left Florida, I had absolutely spiritually, which I didn't understand at the time, nothing left. I was just like a hollow soul walking around. And what happened to me was that I fell down. I drank Southern Comfort, which was like my favorite, and I fell down and I broke my nose on Mexican tile floor. It was the day before Christmas, 1994, and I was 17 with a broken nose. I was looked at myself in the mirror, and I just thought, like, this is what your life is. You can't read, you can't write, you have no family, you have no place to live, you can't stop doing drugs and drinking. And I don't know, but I had one of those, like, it was like my first mini spiritual awakening. And basically what my head said was, you need to call your grandparents who live in Chicago and ask for help. I don't know where it came from, because, like, the idea that I had a problem had never, ever, ever crossed my mind. It had never crossed my mind. And I called them on Christmas Eve, 1994, and I said to my grandparents, who did not know the way that I lived, as far as I was concerned, they didn't know the way my mom had lived all these years. They like, have a little bit of money and a nice house in the suburbs in Chicago. And I said, I'm dying, is what I said. How I knew that, I don't know. I mean, I know because I was, like, really sick, but I called them. They said, we'll send you a ticket. They sent me a ticket. I moved to Chicago on January 12th, 1995. My mother, as a matter of fact, picked me up from the airport. She had been living in Chicago for 8 months, and she was pregnant. and she was fat. And I, you know, a crackhead is sober when they start gaining weight, you know. So seeing my mom when I got off the plane and seeing how she was heavy just was like a warm feeling inside for me, because I had a feeling like if my mom can do it, because she was obviously getting better because she wasn't skinny, you know, if my mom could do it, maybe so could I. It's just like was a thought. You know, I have a million thoughts. I can barely catch them. And that was just like a thought that ran through my head. I went straight into Elmhurst Hospital. I was, and this is the condition that I was in when I got here. I was 94 pounds. I was malnourished and dehydrated. I had acute bladder, kidney, and urinary tract infection. I had scabies, which is a sexually transmitted disease from head to toe. It's like body lice, so I was always itching. Long dreadlocks with bugs on them. I was really sick, you know, really, like, ill. Not only mentally, I was, that's another story, but physically, I was really sick at 17 years old, and I went to the hospital, and they said, you know, you have a problem with drugs and alcohol, and I was like, I mean, nobody where I came from ever got sober, as far as I know. Nobody ever said alcoholic. I mean, you just drank and smoked crack, and that was what you did. I mean, it was like, I don't ever remember anybody saying, yeah, you know, I need to go to an AA meeting. I don't remember anybody ever talking like that ever, or suggesting that somebody else might have a problem. I mean, you just didn't even talk about where I was using it. And I basically heard them say, when the doctor said you need to quit doing drugs and alcohol, basically what I heard is you need to quit doing drugs. I thought, I'm 17 years old. I don't have a problem with alcohol. I barely drink. If there's other drugs around, alcohol was like second. I didn't care about it. So what I did is I got out of that treatment center, and my mom who was pregnant, had a little apartment in Villa Park, and I moved in with her. It was a really huge change. It was the first time I lived with her in 5 years. And I moved in there, and I was like, I'm not going to use drugs anymore. I'm going to do something with my life. I started taking GED classes at a local college, and then you're at the local college and you see somebody with dreadlocks and you think, oh man, I really want to be sober, but there's a guy with dreadlocks. Like, ooh. You know, and the next thing I know, I was like hanging out with this guy with the poncho and the dreadlocks, and the next thing you know, I'm drunk, and then whatever happened to trying to get my life together, I have no idea, but I didn't finish those GED classes. And what I ended up doing was getting a fake ID, an Illinois fake ID. And so I got a fake ID, and I drank in the local bars in Villa Park. It's not a nice neighborhood. It's I was used to the kind of neighborhood it was, you know, very trashous. And so there was like two bars. There was Friends and Company, and then there was VP Sports Bar. So basically, I went to Friends and Company, and then I went to VP Sports Bar, and then I went back to Friends and Company, and then I went to VP Sports Bar, and at 17 years old, that was where my life was. And I was able to get a job at a local diner and do waitressing, because that was all I was going to be at the rate. That was what my mom was when she was able to work, and that was all I was going to be, was a waitress who could not even work an 8-hour shift without drinking. And I couldn't. So this is funny because I'm in Georgia. I always tell this story and nobody ever knows what I'm talking about. But I'm in a bar, I guess, and I meet a guy who's traveling from California. He says he's moving to Tybee Island, Georgia. Tybee Island? Everybody's always like, where's that? But you guys know where that is, right? And I guess I said I wanted to go with him. I guess that's what happened, because I woke up there like 2 days later. I really did. I did. And I lived there. I worked at the Ore House. It's a restaurant, the Ore with an O House. Okay? Nobody ever believes that that's the name of it, but that is the name of it. That's where I worked. I drank there. There's a bar on every corner there. It's awesome. That's the best place in the whole world if you're at your bottom. I mean, it was awesome. It was really awesome there. And after 3 months, this guy was like, Kathy, Carrie, Kelly, whatever your name is, you got to go home. And because I was like, you know, really bad. I mean, I was like one of those suicidal drunks. I never went a full month without trying to kill myself. I tried to drown myself. I tried to cut myself. I tried to crash. I crashed cars. Well, I kept crashing cars in sobriety for attention too, but we'll talk about that later. I just really didn't want to be alive. And I'm, thank you, you know, God, for not actually me succeeding any of those times I tried, because my life is amazing today. So I left. It was Labor Day weekend. I went back to Illinois. I got a job at that same restaurant, Copper Kitchen. And I remember a woman coming in. So funny. I used to see her at the bar, and she would flash her boobs if somebody would buy her a beer. And she was like, it doesn't matter what her name is, but she would do like these weird things. And I saw her in the restaurant with this older gentleman, and I was listening, because I have elephant ears, and she was saying, my life is so good now. And I hadn't seen her in a bar in a while, and she looked kind of a little bit more heavy, and she was like, my life is so good. I love the 12 steps. And I was like, what is she talking about? What is wrong with her? And it was like, that was in like the end of September. And then I drank, and I tried some controlled drinking, thank God, in October, where I would go play bingo. And I would say, if I win, I'll go to the bar. If I don't win, I'll go home. But I just always went to the bar. You know, I never... So that's my proof that my controlled drinking didn't work, because I went to the bar anyways. Either I went broke, because I bought like... Because you don't just buy like... If you're an alcoholic, like a couple bingo cards. You have like a whole table full of bingo cards, and you're like... You know, if you've ever played bingo, you get really crazy with it. And because I don't do anything normal, nothing in moderation, you know. So my controlled drinking didn't work. And in the end of October, I'll tell you what happened to me. I went out. I worked Monday through Thursday. So basically, Thursday night at the restaurant when I got off at 8 o'clock, I pretty much drank from 8 o'clock on Thursday night right around till Monday morning when I needed to start at 11. And that's what it was like for me. Now, I drank in between Monday through Thursday, but from Thursday till Monday morning, I pretty much drank. And I drank on Mannheim. It's a street in Chicago where the bars are open 24/7. They actually close for maybe an hour or two when you just sat in the parking lot. And that's where I drank. My life was disgusting. I was 18. I was bringing men home that were 5-6 times my age. I mean, not 6. That would be 120. But, oh. I mean, really. I exaggerate, too. Honest. Oh, guys that were my mother's age, you know? And... I'm always putting my foot in my mouth. So my life was just, it was really, really bad. I was doing all these things, and it was just, I would wake up, and I lived right by this train station in these apartments with my mom, and I would go across the street. When I woke up, I would go across the street, and I would get a little fifth of Southern Comfort, a little fifth of Amaretto, because in the end, that's all I could afford, and that would start my morning. I would have this fifth of Amaretto that I bought from the White Hen, which is like 7-Eleven, and that's how I would start my morning every day. And, you know, like 15 minutes before I was walking across the tracks, I was telling myself, I'm never going to do this again. Because I would wake up with tattoos. I have 5 tattoos. One of them I remember getting. And that was, I have a big AA symbol on my back that I got at 60 days sober. Don't do it. But I knew, you know what, I've never relapsed, and I knew from the time I came here that I needed to be here, so I guess I thought, you know, I was going to need to be here whether I was or not, you know, screw it, put the AA symbol on there. And so there was a lot of consequences for my drinking, you know, like tattoos. And so I was working in this restaurant, and this is when the miracle happened. AA members would come in for fellowship. And if you, next time you're at a meeting and you think about not going to the restaurant for fellowship, just go, because you never know whose life you're going to change from just being you, you know. And the AA members would come, and they would ask for me. Why? I don't know. But I was like, 95 pounds, long hair, smelled like boobs, smelled like booze. I had a fifth of Southern Comfort in my pocket. My uniform was too big. I really reeked. I'm sure some of them that were newly sober saw me out, and I didn't remember them. And the waitresses in the restaurant would say, "Oh no, here come those AAs." Nobody liked to wait on the AAs, in case you guys don't know that. And I would be like, "Oh no, here come those AAs too." But really, I didn't know what an AA was. I had no idea. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I did know is there was men and women, young and old, gay or straight, black and white. There was like a melting pot of people. People that normally would not mix, right? That's what was there at the table. And they were so nice to me. But there was this one guy, Eugene P., and he was so rude. He was like, "You're going to die before you're 21. And I'd be like, "Great." You know, who cares? Thank you. You know, but he was so mean. He was so mean. And on December 17th, 1995, 11 months after I moved to Chicago, he framed me, that guy. He set me up. He came back on a Monday night, 1 minute before my shift was over, with two of the cutest newcomer guys I've ever seen in my life. Still, to this day, they were the hottest men in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just like, and they sat down, they said, "Kelly, will you sit down with us?" And I was like, you know what I mean? Yes, I will. They were like, "Do you want to come to an AA meeting with us tonight?" I'm like, "AA, BA, BB, wherever you guys are going, let's go. Come on." I mean, my higher power knew what I needed to get here, you know, because I was really lonely. Were there any lonely women in here at the end? I mean, I was so lonely. I was like, "Anything, please, and I'll pay you," you know. It was really bad. So I went to my first AA meeting, and thank you, everybody that's been here longer than, you know, 6 years and 10 months, thank you for staying. And making this available for me, because when I got here, I mean, I crawled through those doors, and it was a small meeting. It was a first step meeting. There was all men, all over the age of 35, which was ancient when you're 18, and they were just drinkers, and they were from this small suburb, and I had absolutely nothing on the outside in common with these gentlemen. Nothing. And I don't really remember anything they said, to tell you the truth, about their story or about alcoholism. What I do remember is, "We're going to love you until you learn to love yourself," which was like, great, 13 men. I'm like, all right. And they said, "Keep coming back." And I heard that, "Keep coming back." It had been a long time since anybody had asked me to come back. I was like, okay. And here's the most amazing thing. So I drank at Friends and Company, and I drank at VP Sports Bar, and in the middle of those two bars was a Nona Center East, and that was the club that I got sober in. And so what I would do is I would go to Friends, and then I would go to AA meeting, and then I would go to VP Sports Bar for 14 days or 17 days. My sobriety date is January 6th, and they 12-step me on December 17th. So for that period of days, I went to a meeting every day, and I went to a meeting every day wasted, because that's how I needed to be to walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am never, never mad when there's a wet drunk that walks into my home group. I'm like, you know what, there's a seat next to me empty. Or here's a seat, not really next to me, but no, because Becca sits there, and she's here, and you know, she knows the truth, so I don't want to lie. So I came every day, and on January 5th, I heard a guy say, Pontiac Joe, he was speaking. It was a Saturday night speaker at this club. We had a steak, Saturday night steak dinner, and that's where I learned to cook, as a matter of fact. He said, and I swear he was looking at me. Did you ever feel like that, where the speaker's like looking at me? Maybe it's just my self-centeredness, but I swore he was like looking right at me, and he said, "I don't know, but I'm sure you guys were saying this, but like, I didn't really get you have to not drink to be an AA. Like, I got that you can have a better life, but like, I miss don't drink. So I was always drunk, and he was like, and he said that, and I was like, don't drink. And I kind of like looked around like, are all these people not drinking? Jeez. And then he said, if you don't want to drink, which I didn't, I really did not want to drink. He said, go home, put your keys under your bed at night, and while you're down there, say thanks. And when you need to get your keys to leave in the morning and you're down there on your knees getting your keys, say please. And I did that, and I haven't had a drink since. I haven't. Thank you. Thank you. It hasn't been an easy almost 7 years for me, and that's what I'm going to spend. I know you guys probably want to get out here, go dance into the open mic night. That's where I'm going to be. But I'll tell you a little bit what it's like, what it's been like for me from 18 to 25. Once again, thank you to the people that have been here longer than me. This is an amazing place to grow up. I can't imagine a better place to grow up than in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has just been awesome. My sponsor, when she speaks, Polly, she always says, and great events have come to pass. And that's what I'm going to spend the next 15 or so minutes talking about, some of the great events that have happened in my life and some of the not so great things that have happened. When I first got sober, I was 18 and I was crazy. And my mom had that baby. And right after my mom had that baby, she went back to doing drugs, to smoking crack. So I got sober in this house for a year, a little over a year, with a mom who was drinking back box wine and smoking crack and literally like blowing it at me. And I had this 6-month-old brother, and he has his name is Tommy, and he has Down syndrome and he's autistic, and he was really a handful. And here was this baby, and here was my mom and all these men she had coming in and out. So I took this baby and I went to meetings. And the reason I'm telling you what it was like for me is when I was really new is because I have a privilege and an honor of working with a lot of women. And a lot of times you hear, like, I can't get sober because I'm around it. You got to change your people, places, or things. I don't know anything about that except for that. If you want this program, it's here. It's not for the people that need it, because a lot more people than the people in this room need it in Georgia. It's for the people that want it. And I wanted it. I wanted this program. And even though that was my environment, I was able, because of you guys, to stay sober. So I got sober in this little club in Villa Park. Everybody was much older than me. I played dominoes. The older gentlemen stayed there with me overnights, and the nights that I thought if I went home I would use. We played dice, we played cards, we played dominoes. They just kept me busy. They kind of like took me under their wing, these old guys. And it was just great. And at 34 days sober, I did the best thing that I think you can do if you're a young person. I went to a young people's convention. And it was like 500 young guys. I'm sure there was girls there too. But I was like, I mean, I had, for 34 days, I had been around, you know, 90-year-olds as far as I was concerned. And they were like young men, and they were sober, and they were enthusiastic by me, and they were enthusiastic about AA, and I hooked up with these young people. And the reason I'm telling you this is because, you know what? Hooking up with them didn't get me a sponsor. It didn't. My honesty date is way different than my sobriety date. It didn't get me honest. It didn't keep me faithful. But you know what it did? It kept me busy. And I joined these committees, and I got a service commitment. I wouldn't be sober. I got a service commitment on a city that was bidding for a regional convention. It's called Glurky Pod. It's no longer around. Great Lakes Regional Convention. And in 1996, I got on their bid committee. They were bidding to bring this convention to their town. And I was the hospitality chair, because it was what they gave the newcomers, I guess. Sorry if Tommy's in here. Are you in here? He's the hospitality chair, right? Sorry. But that's what they gave me. I'm not sure. Sorry. There I go again. So that's what I did. And like I said, I was a wreck. I didn't do anything right except for I showed up for that commitment. I showed up for that lousy committee meetings where everybody was smoking, everybody was arguing, everybody was talking and arguing about money, and I didn't know what was going on except for that. If I wasn't there when they went to Michigan to bid on this convention, nobody would put the hospitality room together. Now, I know that's not true. Somebody else would have done it. But I felt like I needed to continue to go AA meetings, because in March, now this was in, you know, February when we went to, or in April when we went to Michigan to bid on this conference, I needed to be there. And it kept me involved. That commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous kept me involved long enough for you guys to wrap your arms around me. Because in the beginning, I was like, tough girl. I was like, I pull my cigarettes out with my bare feet. I don't hug me. You know, I was like very, like if you put a mean face on, people won't come up to you, Kelly. You know, I was like, really, I was just really, really afraid. And you guys were the longer. So then after that, we actually, I think we got the convention that year or maybe the next year. But then I was on the host committee and that commitment kept me sober. And basically what service commitment. And then I became an alternate GSR, which was just an amazing thing. And I started learning about Chicago AA General Service, which is probably boring to a lot of people in here. But it was something about me that just, it was just really amazing. One, because when I got sober, I didn't know how to read. And being involved in general service, I actually had a service sponsor that was willing to sit down with me and help me read the literature about the traditions, about the concepts. I had somebody, I wasn't reading about the steps. At this point in my sobriety, but I was learning about the traditions and the concepts. And it was a way to lock me into Alcoholics Anonymous until the miracle happened. And what happened to me was at 4 years of sobriety and 22 at the time, I had a job that I had been in for about 3.5 years. I was making about double my age, maybe a little bit more than that. I had gotten my GED, and I had scored like in the top 10% or something of anybody who's ever taken it. I'd gone to 2 years of college. My mom was sober. I had a relationship with her. I had an amazing relationship with my brother. I had like 8 sponsees following me around that I was bossing around. And I had a boyfriend, I had an apartment, like I had all this stuff. And you know what I said? I got this stuff. That's what I thought. Look at all the stuff I got. Look at who I am. Look at what I did. And so I heard somebody say like something about humility and something about prayer. And so I prayed for humility. And my car was stolen by a newcomer. Brand new car. I had no insurance because when you're me, you don't need car insurance. And I lost my position at my firm. We got bought out by another company. That boyfriend, that sweet little boyfriend, broke up with me. Those sponsees all of a sudden didn't want what I had. I needed to change apartments. Like these things started, I said at the time, they were ripped from me. Oh, I lost that scholarship to that college because when my car got stolen, I was so sad. I got a C and I lost everything. So what I was at about 4 years of sobriety, I was a blubbering idiot. And when I was at meetings, new people would come up to me and say, "It's going to be okay." You're like, "I'm 4 years sober. What do you mean?" But they thought I was new because I was a blubbering idiot. I was absolutely devastated that God took all this stuff from me. All the things that I got, right? All the stuff that I had worked so hard for to get were all gone. And I was nothing. And what that forced me to do is it forced me to take the bus to work, it was so humiliating for me. But when I was on the bus and when I was walking to the bus stop, I was praying. I was praying. I was praying. I was actually willing to start a relationship with my higher power. I was willing, even though I wasn't even sure at that time that I believed, I was willing to start because I was in so much pain. I was so humiliated and I got this amazing sponsor. Her name was Lisa. She was just like, step, step. She was really kind of mean sometimes. She was like, step, 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 step. And she started slowly, slowly taking me through the steps, which I had dabbled in before, but I had written 4 inventories. A lot of them I put lies on. I was just unable to be honest. I can't believe I haven't drank. It's just amazing. It's unbelievable. She started talking about the steps. So what I started doing, I started following, and this is where my life really started to change. I started to follow my sponsor around because she was going through a divorce. She had just lost her husband. She had just lost her mom, and she had watched her mom take her last breath. My sponsor was really desperate and willing, and there's something magical about having a sponsor who is, she was 12 years sober at the time. She was really desperate and willing. There's something magical about that, and she was following her sponsor around, TJ. So we were all, it started out, there was like six of us, and then all of a sudden we were just following each other around, and the next thing you know, the group was like 40 people. And my sponsor was asked to speak at a meeting in Oak Lawn, Illinois, and it's called Oak Lawn Big Book Group. And in Chicago, we have a lot of different AA. I'm sure there's a lot of different AA here. But this AA was AA that I did not like. It was AA where people dress nice. When the women were asked to speak, they were in a pantsuit or a skirt. The men, when they were asked to speak, they wore ties. And it was, I wore sweatpants, T-shirts with no bras to AA meetings at 4 years sober. I had no self-worth. It's not funny. I had no dignity, no self-respect, no self-worth, no self-esteem. I was just, but I had done it all, And I went to this meeting, and of course I was like, oh, God. But I had this, love for Alcoholics Anonymous that's always been in my heart. And I went there, and this was about 2.5 years ago, almost 3 years, and I went to this meeting. My sponsor was speaking at it. Now, I was only at this meeting because I was desperate enough to follow my sponsor around. And I was in the third row. I was with two of the women that I sponsor, and I saw this man sitting in the front row that when an older gentleman, an older man, and somebody with more sobriety time than him came up, this gentleman stood up and let this guy sit in his seat, and I thought, man, that's really nice. Like, in the kind of AA I went to, people weren't doing that, and I kind of took a liking to that guy. And Rich, can you stand up? That's Rich. That's my husband. That's the one that's sleeping with the speaker. Just him today. Can you believe that? I saw him, and I saw his respect and his love for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, I want what he has, literally, spiritually, too. And I saw him there, and I saw him, a few nights later at a meeting, and then I saw him at an AA dance, and he was kind enough to ask me if I wanted to ride home and then walk me to my door, and I actually, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in this room and willingness that God gave me, I actually had a man ask me out on a date. That is amazing. Maybe has a lot of women had that happen? I had never had that happen. I was not the type of girl, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, that people asked out. That's not who I was. Because you know what? Gentlemen in this program don't ask out women that don't have any self-esteem, self-respect, dignity, honor, sobriety. And he asked me out. And I have been always, for the last 2.5 years that I've been with my husband, actively sponsored through my marriage. Through the first date, my sponsor told me what to do. She told me what to wear. When he said, will you go out with me? I said, I'd be honored. Because that's what I was taught to say in AA. I said, I'd be honored. Like, if somebody asked me to speak or something. And he was a member of another strong home group. And, the AA that I was not familiar with. And I would talk to him on the phone, and he would talk about principles. He would talk about the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, things that I had never heard. He would talk about looking your best at your home group. He would talk about reaching your hand out to the new person, whether you like them or not. I was like, he was just talking about all this stuff and what happened, because enthusiasm breeds enthusiasm. I caught fire with what my husband was doing, and I would travel with him to his home group. And a little bit was because he's so cute. But a lot of it was because I was just excited about this new AA. All of a sudden, sitting in discussion meetings and talking about broken down cars and loss of jobs and bad moods wasn't working for me. What was working for me was I was going to these meetings where there was speakers that were sharing experience, strength, and hope. Sometimes I left these discussion meetings, and I don't know if anyone can relate, but I left and I felt like hopeless. Like, oh my God, that guy was 7 years once to blow his brains out. It's looking bad for me, And I go to these meetings, and then I started going to these meetings where the speaker had to have over 5 years, and they were talking about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what it's like now is always better. Even in the bad times, what it's like now is always better. Always better. So I started going to these meetings, and it was like an hour away where we went to these meetings, because we live in the city and they were in the suburbs. And about a year and a half ago, driving back in traffic from our home group that we went to twice a week, my husband and I said, why don't we create this group in our neighborhood? Why don't we start a home group where it's safe for men and women, young or old, black or white, gay or straight, to come and be safe? Why don't we create that? There was nothing around us. And so we started talking a little bit. We talked to our sponsors. We talked to some other activists, enthusiastic people in our neighborhood. And today, and about a year and a half ago, we started the Chicago Foxhole Group. And can you guys stand up? 10 of them drove here 14 hours to see me. Thank you. So I have a group of like 80 or 90 people. I have, listen to me, I made it. I go to my home group on Wednesday night and I see like, you know, 80 or 90 people that are pretty young. Most of us are really young. So what we have now going on is a pretty young group of young people with manners. That's what I like to call it. We look nice. We don't swear from behind the podium. We don't wear jeans and flip-flops to our home group. We try to be an example for the new person that will. Now, these are just the principles that we do at our home group. I'm not saying they're the right principles for Alcoholics Anonymous, because what I do know is that I am actively involved in the right kind of AA for me. What you do might kill me. What I do might kill you. I'm not sure now. I think it will help all you. But it works for me. It works for me. I've been in other types of AA where it's a little bit less structured. And you can wear sweat. I mean, you could wear sweatpants and a t-shirt with no bra in my home group. People would just kind of like, look at you. Not badly. But we try to, at my home group, the people with time are trying to steer us newcomers in the right direction. You know, that this is an amazing program, and if we don't cherish it and pay attention to the traditions and to the concepts, like, there ain't going to be no more AA. And an amazing, amazing thing happened to me. And earlier this year, I have the privilege of having a ton of sponsees. I don't know why. I don't know what they want from me, but they call me all the time, and I sponsor this one woman who was pregnant, and she got pregnant, and she had a baby, and the baby's here. Juliet, you've probably heard her. And say hi! And I was in the room when she was born. Now, I don't know if she's alcoholic. The verdict's still out. Maybe. But I love that baby so much. I don't have my own kids yet. But I want AA to be here for her and for my kids. And I'm glad it's here for me. And if I don't conform to those principles and those traditions and those, it's not going to be here. I mean, I don't mean to, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir. Everybody here is active in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if I don't follow those, it's clear to me that I might be dead, but little kids like that, they're not gonna have anywhere to go. So what's really, really special about my home group is that almost all of us are involved, actively involved in general service. I am, in January, I'm finishing out my 2-year term of DCM, which is the district chair of my area. I was alternate GSR and GSR, and you know, and now I'm the DCM. I'm getting ready to do that, and I'm thinking about going for area chairperson or maybe delegate someday. Can you believe that? I think that for me, I need to have unity, which are you guys. Thank you. Service, which is my dedication to area service and recovery, and that's the last thing I want to talk about because I'm almost out of time. I believe wholeheartedly in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that are in How It Works in the Big Book. They're not in a workbook that somebody wrote. They're in the Big Book. And how to do them, I believe, is in the Big Book. And in the 12 and 12. That's where the solution is. Now, I tried a lot of things. I tried Hazelton guides and other fourth-step guides and workbooks that people in AA have written. And what has worked with me is sitting down with one alcoholic and doing the steps, being honest. They're really not hard if you read them out of the book. It's really easy. You know, can I concede to my innermost self? Yes. Am I willing to believe? All I got to do is be willing. Can I turn it over? The 12 and 12 says, turning your will and your life over. The third step in the 12 and 12 says, it's as easy as saying the serenity prayer in times of emotional disturbance. Can I write an inventory? They pretty much write it out for us. They show us how to do it. Can I find somebody in my community that I can trust to read this to? Yeah, I can. That's step 5 already. That easy. Can I get down? Can I be by myself for an hour? Can I do that? Can I actually, I tell my sponsees, no talking on the phone for that hour, no cleaning, no masturbation. I go through the whole thing. Because those are things that I'm thinking about doing in that hour, you know, anything but think about the first 5 proposals. And have I left anything out? And then I get down on my knees and I say the 7th step prayer, with or without my sponsor, however you do it. I like to do it with my sponsor. I have my 8th step list, guys, when I wrote my inventory. I go out and I make those amends. I don't believe in taking my 8-step list and breaking it down into 3 columns. People I'm willing to do, people I'm not willing to do, people I can't. I just make those amends. My sponsor, I had 83 people on my amends list, and one by one, I made those amends, whether it was a direct amends or indirect amends or a letter. I made those amends. They're done. I'm having to make new amends because I still make mistakes, if you can believe that. And but then 10, 11, 12 are my daily maintenance steps. That's it. If you can do the first 9, and even you can start step 10 when you're still in the middle of making your 9-step amends. Because it says we commence this way of living as we're cleaning up the wreckage of our past or something like that. I'm not a good quoter. But it says that I start that way of living. So basically what I do is for 10 and 11, this is what I do. I read the questions out of the Big Book. I ask myself those things, you know. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with the questions, but for me it's always yes, 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 yes. Were you thinking of yourself most of the time? Yes. Were you dishonest? Yes. Were you selfish? Yes, 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 yes. But the last questions is... The last question there is, I think it was, were you thinking of what you could pack into the stream of life or something like that? And when I get to that question, I also think about the good things I've done. And as the result of actively working the steps for a couple of years now, usually my slate is pretty even. If not, the good things are a lot more. So I've gone from being, after just working the steps, that's all. I mean, that was the big change in my life, this home group, this new sponsor, these sponsees, my husband, and the steps have changed my life. So I'm not sure what else there is. I don't do much meditation yet. I do my morning prayers. I pray through the day like it says to do whenever I feel out of it. But for me, I believe that action is the loudest prayer. And I answer my phone when my sponsees call, whether I want to or not. It's not an option for me not to pick up that phone. It used to be. I used to think I got to talk to the pretty sponsees or the sponsees that I thought might make it. Now I talk to anybody who is humble or willing enough to say, Kelly Landry, will you be my sponsor? I answer all the calls. I believe for me, that is the biggest gift that I could give to God is to help his other children, you know? And the last thing I want to say is that this has been, I wish that I could meet all of you. My sponsor speaks like all the time, like 49 weekends a year or something ridiculous like that. And she says that, you know, she doesn't love it, but what she likes about it is she gets to meet people from all over the world. And if I don't get to meet you this weekend, I really want to. I'd really like to meet everybody in this room and get to know you. I just, what's happening to me this 7th year is my heart is opening up. And I'm learning to love, and I know there's a lot of people that have been in the 7th year. It's just an amazing year. I'm feeling compassion. Not a lot, but I'm feeling it. When it starts to happen to a person that it's never happened to before, you feel it. you know? And when I see somebody in pain, I want to help them, not because I know it's the solution for me. But today I really want to help people. And being asked to speak here was just, I don't want to say it was a dream come true, because I was really nervous and really scared. And Carrie was just awesome, because I was like shaking and I couldn't really eat much. And it's just been, it's been crazy. But this is a life beyond my wildest dreams. Like, this is it. I never dreamed that I would be up here talking to you guys. And I guess they say, like, this was such a big deal for me this last month. I was, like, obsessed about this talk. And, you know, I have to remember, and I was talking about this earlier on the plane with Dawn, my problems are so small today. And what I'm sure of today is that my problems today were my dreams when I got here, you know? I never, ever, ever thought that my life would be as good as it is now. So thank you all for listening to me. Thank you.